from WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made last Thursday night, February 12th. Rochester Mayor Lovely Warren delivered the State of the City address on the grounds of her alma mater, Wilson Magnet High School. She spoke of reducing the city's stifling poverty, of attracting new businesses, creating new jobs, building better schools, and making sure the neighborhoods are safer. This hour, Mayor Warren joins us to talk about her vision for the city, what she's already learned as mayor, and what she'd like to see, at least before the end of her term. We may even look well beyond the end of her term. Mayor Warren, thank you for coming back to Connections. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you. Thank you for having me, Evan.
I promise we're going to be looking forward here, but you have a chance to take stock now. How would you grade your first year as mayor?
Well, I think that we had our challenges on some things, but when I look at the work and the things that we accomplished, I think that we did a superb job on moving the city where it needs to go when it comes down to issues related to crime and making our neighborhood safer, when it comes down to building jobs and connecting businesses and trying to take Rochester where it needs to go as far as our manufacturing is concerned, and also when it comes down to really working with our school district and also our partners around education. And so when you look at what we wanted to focus on and what we wanted to get done as a city, we did that.
We are going to be taking your phone calls later this hour for Rochester Mayor Warren. If you want to join the conversation, it's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. Let me do this order of business and get it out of the way before you call and ask her about plowing sidewalks. Mayor Warren, everybody wants to ask me on Twitter about why their sidewalk's not plowed. Let's take 10 seconds and get plowing out of the way. This has not been an easy winter for any Northeast city.
No, and the snow, of course, continues to fall, and it has been hit Rochester hard, and we've had crews out around the clock plowing our streets and plowing our sidewalks, and we're doing our best to make sure that everything is clear. But according to City Code, which I know a lot of people don't want to hear about, it is the homeowner or the business owner's responsibility to plow the sidewalks, and we do, as a courtesy after 4 inches, send out people to plow the sidewalks. We would do our best to make sure that the roads and the sidewalks are always clear, but you know, when you get the number of inches of snow, and it's been cold, so the ice, the snow isn't melting, and so it stays put. And then you have plows that come along, and they put it back, on the sidewalk. So we're doing our best. We have a great team out there working hard, and if you're having issues of concern and you want to report it, you could always call my office of the Mayor's Office of Constituent Services at 428-7045, and we'll be glad to make sure that that's taken care of.
All right, 428-7045. Do not call the show to talk about plowing. You can call that number if you'd like. That's out of the way. Let's talk about another P word, and that's poverty. You hit that in your speech, and I know that is first and foremost in your mind in the city. Let me ask you a very specific question. Why do we continue to see, we've seen the numbers get worse. Why do we continue to see the numbers get worse, putting Rochester around third in the country, leading the nation in cities its size in extreme poverty, and that's people living at half the level or below? Why, this is a complicated question, but at the top of the list for you, why is that happening here?
Well, I believe it's happening for a couple of reasons. It's very complex, and I'll approach it in to what we saw as a community and as a city when we came in. We took a look at that, and what we found is that Rochester is really great at providing the essential services, basic needs, where you would, you know, we call it keeping people on a treadmill of basic needs. And so we would do a great job at providing for making sure that they have room and board, making sure that they have food, making sure that they have clothes, and those basic needs. But when it comes down to teaching people and giving them the support that they needed to actually climb up a stairway out of poverty, what are those steps that you need to cover in order to go, you know, get your GED or your TAS test taken? Take that. What if you wanted to go to college and go to MCC? How do you get there? What's the process? How do you fill out a FAFSA form? And so what we found is that many of our agencies were doing great work and providing for those basic needs, but it wasn't a continuum of care. So you would start with a family, for example, our Healthy Moms program. You start with a family that from the time the mother is pregnant until the time the child reaches the age of 2. And then that family is out of that program, where there was no successful handoff to another program if that family wasn't ready. And so then you don't see see the child until the child is 5 years old and getting ready to go into kindergarten. And so you had this gap. You invested in the front end, but then you lost track, and now you're dealing with this family 3 years later, and they're in the same position. And so we call it, you know, I think one of the things that we didn't do, and that is a successful handoff, and making sure that we are continuing people along the process to pull themselves out of poverty if that's what they want to do, and giving them the support to do that. There's also institutional barriers. So a single mom that has gotten a job and wants to take her family from a place of I'm being on social services, the one thing that she loses, the first thing that she loses, you know, if she makes over a dollar, is her rent. You know, they take away her rent, her social services. They take away her, her food stamps. They take away daycare. And so instead of it being on sort of a sliding scale, we're going to reduce this gradually over time for you. We'll take it all away at once. And so you're making a choice. Do I stay in the situation that I'm in or try to better myself and then get penalized by doing that? And so there's some institutional barriers that are there. The other thing I think we have, some people have become complacent, and so, you know, satisfied in the situation. And when you're satisfied in a situation, then you don't do what it takes to get yourself out of it. And so it has to be a three-pronged approach. The person has to be ready to accept the services that you're willing to provide. The structure that you're working in has to be such that you actually give people the support that they need to make themselves self-sufficient, and it's sustainable over time. And then the other thing, the programs that you have around you have to be done in such a way that they actually complement each other instead of hurt one another in the long run.
Do you think, you don't think most people who are poor are complacent though, do you?
Not at all. Okay. Not at all. Yeah. I think that all those things are interrelated. When I say that some people are complacent, some people are complacent, but I believe that most people, it's the fact that they want to do better. They just don't know how. They don't know where to go for the help. And the reason why I say that is because when we started Operation Transformation, we had a number of Rochester, number of people come to us that wanted to get their GED. They just didn't know where to go in the community to even sign up for a course. They wanted help getting a job, and you know, we helped them to be able to do that. And so you have all these people that want to do better. They just don't have the support network in order to do better. And that's what we want to be able to provide.
I know you know Ed Doherty, who helped write the recent poverty reports for ACT Rochester, the Community Foundation. Ed was on this program about a month ago talking about why his research indicates Rochester has this poverty. And what Ed talked about was the fact that in his research to cities similar sizes, Rochester has one of the highest levels of concentrated poverty, clustered together. And some of the response to that, people called the program and they said, well, look, you can't tell people where to live. You know, unfortunately, sometimes people move to the suburbs. They want to get away from the problems they perceive. You can't tell people where to live. I want to listen to what Ed Doherty had to say in response to that about telling people where to live, concentration of poverty. Let's listen to this, and then we'll come back and talk about it. Can we listen to Ed Doherty? Let's listen here.
Oh, but you can tell people where to live. We tell the poor people where to live. See, that's the problem with that argument. It's not a naturally existing reality. We have made sure that rental housing for the poor is concentrated. So we don't have a naturally occurring market reality. We have a reality that has resulted from decades and decades of restricting the places where we will permit the poor to live.
Do you agree with that, Mayor Warren?
Yes, I do.
And how do you fix that then?
Well, I think that you do what Baltimore did, and you create the market within the area. So, for example, one of the reasons why when I was on city council, we started to look at the Market View Heights neighborhood, which is a very, it's a neighborhood that is has a high concentration of poverty, but you also have, it's connected to home ownership, and you have the public market that's right there. And we figured if we could change the market in Market View Heights, then maybe we could change it everywhere else. And so what we do is we build affordable housing in those particular areas. If you look at, say where Lena Gann Estates and William Warfield and Highland townhouses in, you know, Las Fombellanas. They're all in the same area. And so you concentrated it because that's the way it was designed. If you want to break up the concentration of poverty, then where you build affordable housing has to be outside and in other areas of our community. So what you do is you build the market. What they did in Baltimore is they started by building homes that were worth $40,000. And they were really nice, really affordable, and people purchased those homes. And then they went a block over and they built houses that were worth $50,000. And they were really nice and people purchased those. And then they built houses that were worth $60,000. And so they actually changed the market as they went along. And we can do that here. We just have to be willing to put in that effort to do that.
That's part of something that you'd like to see happen here.
Absolutely. Your city council in December approved the urban renewal project for the Market View Heights area, and we're looking to build that market in that neighborhood first.
844-295-TALK. Before I grab the first couple of phone calls, Kurt on Twitter wants to know regarding poverty. What are your thoughts on our distinction as having the highest rate of childhood poverty, and how can we help? That's mm-hmm. a question I get from a lot of people, is not just, hey, why do we have poverty, but what can I do? I'm not living in poverty. What can I do?
Right. So for childhood poverty, I think that the best way that we can help a child is to make sure that they're getting the best education possible that they can receive, but also that their parent has access to a good quality paying job. What our community can do to help, number one, I think that they can volunteer time. One of the things that we know is that everybody needs somebody to care. And if they volunteer time in either our recreation centers or our libraries, there are different ways that they can do that and spend time with a child that and provide that exposure to other opportunities across our community and our country. I think that that can go a long way. And I say that because you only know what you know. And, you know, where you sit determines what you see. And if you sit in a situation where the only people that are around you are the people that are in your same situation, then you never imagine a life different than that. You don't believe that that's achievable and obtainable. But if people come in and they show you, listen, hard work, study, you know, getting getting good grades, working hard, learning to read, doing your math work, that's how you can pull yourself and help your family along the way. If you own a business, I ask that you hire, one of our young people over the summertime, or even open up the doors to hire other employees of our people that are going through our Operation Transformation Rochester program. And I think that that would be very helpful.
All right, Rochester Mayor Lovely Warren is our guest here. Let me get our first phone call. James, go ahead, James.
Hi. When I watch the news every night, it seems like crime is on the rise in our city. Can you talk to me a little bit about crime and what you're doing to fix it?
James, thanks for the call. And, you touched on this in your State of the City, Mayor Warren. And then actually there's a lot of good numbers in the first year. But again, it's 1 year. Go ahead and address James's question.
Yes, there is some good news in our first year. I think that Police Chief Simonelli and the team over at RPD are doing a great job. First, our homicide clearance rates are almost double the national average. I think that if you commit a crime in our community, people need to know that they are going to be held accountable and they're going to be brought to justice. When we look at our violent crime levels, levels in the 10 years, they're at the second lowest in 25 years. Part one crime, which is how the FBI labels major crimes, is at its lowest in 25 years. We have had fewer than 11,000 part one crimes for the first time in 25 years. There has not been a single year since from 1985 to 2012 when part one numbers dropped below 12,000, and we're actually below 11,000. Robbery and aggravated assaults are at 25-year lows. And so even though these are great numbers, these are no numbers to really shout up and jump up and down about, because we still have a significant amount of crime in our city. And we're still going to work very hard to combat that. And that's the reason why we're going to the 5-section police model, which we will believe will build on that community police relationship, return our officers to the neighborhoods in a way where we can hone in on those relationships, as well as make sure that we're doing everything that we possibly can to deter crime, but also also to let people know that we're taking this very seriously.
Take it from, let me just make a point to James. Take it from someone who spent 11 years in local commercial television news. And I don't say this as an apologist for the city or the mayor or anybody, but there are times where the news, if you report just incident by incident without context, the danger is every night you think that the city is on fire. And we've had those conversations, and I know our friends in commercial television news, for example, because you mentioned you turn on the news and it seems like the city's on fire. Just try to look at the context here. Now, that doesn't mean that 1 year means that we've got everything figured out or that the trend will continue. And in a year, we'll come back and talk to the mayor to see if those numbers continue to move in a good direction. But I think that without context, sometimes we fail to see the big picture. Is that fair?
Yes, absolutely. And sometimes, you know, and to be honest, to be clear, perception is reality for a lot of people. And so it takes us being able to, you know, change that perception. And I believe that by going back to community policing, by going to the five-section police model, by reporting on these numbers and continuing to hit home the message that, you know, accountability is what we're going after, that we'll be able to continue the trend.
How is your relationship with the police, the union?
Well, you know, we have had a good relationship. I was the first mayor in 19 years to be able to settle a police union contract and have that contract ratified. And I know that there are some concerns that are being raised over the police reorganization and the actual purchasing of buildings. And we, from the very beginning, have been very transparent about reorganizing in place. And in the, you know, we have leases on many of the buildings that we currently have, and we want to deal with that. We also have some other buildings that we have to look at to, you know, structurally to see about those. And so we want to handle this purchasing of buildings after we reorganize, because we want to make sure that the process is such that it's driven by data and not by what we might feel or what we think it actually the reorganization that is in place right now is all driven by data and community relationships and talking to the community. So, you know, we're working on our relationship, and we'll continue to work together to make sure that we're doing everything possible for the citizens of Rochester.
In your State of the City, you gave a shout out a couple times to the remarkable Amy Pearson. And she is an amazing woman. And,
yes, she is.
She actually, I think, has been just about to every community event supporting police, supporting the city. It appears you've kept a very good relationship with her. Some of her family members didn't like some of what you said on social media last year. And you know, look, I think last summer, the whole country had a bit of a conversation about policing, race in America. I think that conversation continues. I think it's important. You had some strong words on social media. I know some of the Pearson family didn't like it. Do you look back in your first year at that moment and regret that at all? Or is that unfortunately a symptom of the fact that we need to have tough conversations?
I think that we have to have tough conversations. And I think that, you know, as I explained then, you know, When you're in the position that I am in, you want to support the community and you want to be able to support the police and you want everybody to act accordingly. And I think that we have a great police department here and we have a great community here. And we have made great strides in building that relationship and we want to continue to do that. Making our community safer has to be both parties working together. It cannot be an adversarial relationship. Because I tell the community all the time, when something happens, you pick up the phone and you call 911. And when you want an officer to come and want them to be able to remediate that situation, and they do. And when our officers come, they want to feel like they're being supported. And when they come for information about a crime, they want to know that you're being truthful with them. And so this is a relationship like a marriage, you know, where, you know, there's going to be times where we're not always going to agree, but we know for the betterment of our relationship, for the betterment of our family, we have to work together and we have to make it work. And so we're going to find every which way to do that. Now, that doesn't mean that it's always going to be pretty. But as I said at my state of state, one thing that the chief and I have said, the state of the city, one thing that the chief and I have, stated was that we will hold each other accountable. And when I say something or do something that he may not like, he may call, he'll call me up and say, "Lovely, I thought you could have did this or that." And I would say the same thing to him. And I think that that's, you know, having someone that you trust in that position, but also someone that has the pulse and the feelings of the men and women that he's guiding is very important. And I also have to have that relationship with him.
I should also, I will say now, with the mayor in the room here, that I stuck my foot in my mouth on social media last year. It was last year. I'm trying to think of when all. It is 2015, isn't it? Once in a while, when you're in happening, things are happening fast in real time. And if I'm on Twitter, sometimes I run my mouth or I'll shoot off a comment that I sort of regret. And at one point, I indicated, and I apologize for this, that that you made a comment through social media. That I think the clear indication is that you did not make through Facebook. This was after the whole question of what happens with Sanctuary Village, the tent city, people, what happens to the people in those circumstances. And someone unfortunately ends up on your account, and a suburban person is commenting, and there's a back and forth. And you know, I think at that point you reworked your social media policy. So first of all, I apologize for indicating that it was you. Second of all, you know, do you look back and say that was a learning moment? I mean, every person who's a public figure has to figure out what they want to do with social media, whether it's nothing or use it all the time or sort of use it judiciously.
Right. Well, thank you. I accept that apology. And, you know, it was a learning experience because, you know, actually, like, 2 weeks before that, one of my mentors had came to me and said, you need to get off of Facebook. You need to get off of Facebook. You need to revamp who's posting and who's doing, you know, things on your Twitter and your Facebook. And I didn't take it seriously at that point in time. And, you know, this situation happened. And I have been the only elected official, along with, you know, some members of the minority in the county legislature, that have really been looking at this homeless issue and trying to solve it and deal with it. I'm working hard with Sister Grace. And so what I said to even the homeless advocates is that, you know me. You know that I was the only person that was sitting at the table with you that had the power to really control this issue and solve this issue for you. You know that I wouldn't have done this on purpose or said this on purpose or even ordered that act. You know, it was a misunderstanding between the people that were there on Friday and the people that came in and cleaned up on Saturday. We're going to do everything that we can to help you. And that's why I'm thankful to Ken Glazier and Buckingham Properties and being able to work with all of our community partners. But we have been working for months to try to solve this issue. And so, you know, then the new communications director came in and I said, listen, you're charged with figuring out what happened here. And, you know, he did. And he looked into it and he came up with a policy that we can all work from. And it's, you know, you live and you learn. I'm sad that it came to that, but I want people to recognize and to know that, especially when it comes down to our most vulnerable constituents, that we're going to do what we can and what's ever in our power to help them. And, you know, we tried in that situation. And it's, you know, even, you know, I'm thankful that we were able to get them out of this cold because it's been a very brutal winter, and being able to provide a safe place. And it's a temporary place, but we're working even now. Kara Wheeler on my team has been working tirelessly to deal with this issue, and will continue to do so.
Yeah, I'm about to be late for a break, but let me just hit a couple other quick points. It looks to me from the outside that with the Glazers' help, the situation is much improved in just several weeks' time, yes?
Absolutely. We were able to, they allowed us to utilize one of their vacant factory places. They have a warm place. It's staffed 24 hours a day. Our fire department and our police department has worked with the organizers to make sure that it's safe and it's, you know, a place where they can have a warm place to sleep and something to eat during the day. And we'll continue to do that. And we're working on a permanent solution for this hard to serve population.
And when it comes to social media, will you still tweet and use a Facebook here? I confess, no. I make missteps, but I'm going to stay there. And I like when public leaders do too, to some degree.
You'll have to talk to my communications director about that. Okay. As for right now, I don't even have the passwords to any of those.
Wow. Okay. And, you know, with your new communications director who came in, he was tasked with figuring this out. Last word on the subject. Do you now have a sense for who did write those messages?
No. And that's part of the problem. We have, I believe there was 5 people that had the passwords. Mm-hmm. And so if nobody fesses up, our IT department, they they couldn't figure it out. We also talked to a social media expert who said, you know, as long as the person has the password, we can't identify who did this. And, you know, we talked to those individuals sternly, and he had a conversation with them. And that's why he changed the whole policy about who has access and who has passwords to those accounts.
All right. We're going to take a 60-second break, and we're going to talk about development in Rochester in the mayor's State of the City address. She talked about Citygate, Costco, what the Glazers are doing, and obviously the tragic loss of Larry and Jane last year, but that has not diminished the interest in downtown development, seeing that happen. So much more to talk about with Rochester Mayor Lovely Warren after this break, and your phone calls as well. Stay with us on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, we're talking about disciplining teachers. Rochester has a so-called rubber room for teachers who are being investigated for various offenses. And the city school district says, well, they think it's appropriate because right now it's still laborious and difficult to fire bad teachers. A lot of teachers and unions say that's not true anymore. What's the reality? Join the conversation next hour.
A lesson from the Ebola crisis, the disease has been deadliest for the youngest patients, but children's chances of survival may go up with extra love and affection.
We play games, put pictures on the walls, and do whatever we can to try and minimize the horror that the poor kids are going through.
That story today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on WXXI.
Welcome back to Connections. Rochester Mayor Lovely Warren is here. Pat on Twitter has a question, says, we now have one telecom provider capable of delivering broadband speeds. What's the city doing for innovation, competition, consumer protection on a vital piece of infrastructure?
Well, right now we are. I just spoke with County Executive Brooks about this. The city is crisscrossed with a fiber optic infrastructure that many communities don't have, and we have what we call double redundancy and really high speed access to internet. And we don't market that, and we have not allowed for people to utilize that particular asset that we have. And that asset is owned by the county, the city. I think that we have a couple of private fiber tech, Frontier and Time Warner. And so we're going to put together a group, and I talked about this at the State of the City, a group of people to look at this asset and see how do we market it to businesses and make sure that they understand what Rochester has to offer and bring it down to our innovation zone and look to see if businesses are going to come here because of that.
You also talked a lot about the development projects. I want to talk, we'll start with Citygate. You come into office, Citygate's a project that, the Costco project there, was not a done deal by any means when you were taking office. Is that fair to say?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, and you decided we're going to reach across party lines and we're going to get this done. Costco is going to open when?
I believe Costco will open in the first part of the spring. The sign is up. The building is almost up, and they have really started to hire and to accept applications. And so that deal is a reality. And, you know, Anthony Costello and Sons are moving forward with the rest of the development.
And give me a sense for the bipartisan work that went into getting that done.
Well, the county executive called and said, you know, we need a vote to move this project forward. And for some reason, the Democrats are holding out on this. And if you could really help me, that would be great. So I talked to the minority leader, and I spoke to, minority leader Andrews and also to Willie Joe Lightfoot. And I said, you know, this is a project that's important to the city. You know, it's located in the city of Rochester. We need to move it forward. The neighbors have been very supportive of it, and we need to make sure that we bring these jobs, you know, to our community. That's what's important, especially when you have unemployment in some of our most challenged neighborhoods, and Costco pays more than a living wage. And so we talked about it. They agreed that they would go ahead and support it, and we were able to get that vote and move the project forward. And now you have a sign that's up in a building, and everything is moving along really well there.
The county executive, Maggie Brooks, if I remember correctly, endorsed you when you were running for mayor,
yes.
Didn't she?
Yes.
You still have a solid relationship with her.
Yes, we have a great working relationship, and we've worked on a number of different items. We've been able to settle our unarraigned prisoners, issue and save city taxpayers almost $800,000. We have worked on some issues that we have with 911 reimbursement, employee reimbursement, and been able to deal with that. And now we're going to embark on dealing with how to market our fiber optic infrastructure together.
I don't know if the Democrats are going to field a candidate for county executive. Maggie Brooks will be term limited out this year, and so there will be an election in November. How well do you know the Republican candidate, Cheryl DeNolfo?
I've worked together with Cheryl as well, and I can tell you that whoever is in the seat, that we have to work well together. And for me, it's not about, it's about the citizens that we represent. And it's not about being partisan when it comes down to jobs, when it comes down to safe neighborhoods, when it comes down to the education of our children. We have to do whatever we need to do as elected officials to reach across the aisles to get it done on behalf of the people. And that's the attitude that County Executive Brooks and I have. Now, that doesn't mean that we will always agree. It doesn't mean that everything will always be, peaches and cream. But to be able to have that relationship where you can say to one another, we need to get this done on behalf of our citizens because of this particular reason, I think that that's important. And I think that we have to be able to trust each other. So whoever is elected to the seat, whoever the citizens choose to represent them, I'm going to do everything that I can to work with them to get things done.
Could you foresee yourself endorsing Cheryl DeNolfo?
I don't know who the Democratic candidate will be, and I will see.
Do you want to see a strong Democratic candidate?
I think that the Democrats will have to decide as a party who they want as a county executive, and I'll work with whoever the people elect.
That's a good answer, but you are one of the most powerful people in this county. I mean, you're essentially a leader of the Democrats. It's interesting because the Republicans tend to have this history of being very, very unified, and Democrats are a little bit more figure it out internally and maybe divide and conquer a little bit and then unite. But you're not sitting here telling me, hey, I'm going to support a Democrat. We're going to field a strong candidate.
Oh, I of course would love for the Democrats to be able to put up a candidate, but I think that it's more important that whoever is in the seat that I have a working relationship and be able to work with. And so I want that to be the understanding that rather it's a Democrat or Republican or independent, I'm going to work with them. Now, if you talk about party politics, then of course I want a Democrat to run and for us to field a candidate. But if we don't, I want everyone to understand and to know that, I will work with the Republican, candidate or the winner of the seat, the county execs race, to do whatever we need to do on behalf of the citizens that we represent.
Is there division internally in the Democratic Party? All of us on the outside, we hear, Mayor Warren is strong. And then there's a question of, does she get along with Joe Morelli, the Assembly Majority Leader? Dave Gerritsen's the new party chair. We don't really know how things are going with him. Is it divided?
I work with everyone. And, Majority Leader Morelli and I are working together on this anti-poverty task force that the governor has set up. And we have had many meetings and we've talked. And, at times there are, in the past, we have been on separate sides. But when it comes down to the work of the people, we do what we need to do so that they are taken care of. And I think that that's what's most important. And I also work with Dave Gerritsen. And so if the party, comes up with a candidate and are able to field a candidate, then, I will look to see whether my support helps them or rather it hurts them. I think that we have to work together in order to move our community where it needs to go. I'm going to really be excited about pushing forth the agenda that I have that I think is important to the city of Rochester, and that is to increase the number of jobs that we have available here for our residents and make sure that they get the support that they need to fill those particular positions, and also to make our community safer and ensure that our children are being educated in a way that is beneficial for them.
Rochester Mayor Lovely Warren, my guest, in her State of the City, she paid tribute to the Glazers. We lost Larry and Jane last year. There were a lot of questions about, with their loss, would we see certain projects stall? Tower at Midtown, for example. And you talked about that. Update us, for example, on that project.
Well, I'm thankful that King Glacier and Buckingham Properties and Morgan Management were able to move forward with the tower at Midtown. And the windows mostly are all in, and I drive by and I see the construction happening there. Of course, we are, you know, looking to continue the development that's happening on a Midtown parcel. And Sibley Building is moving forward as well. We just announced a couple months ago that HTR High Tech Rochester is going to go there. It's our hope that we'll have 150 to 200 both senior and market rate homes going into the Sibley Building. We're expanding the police station there to a 24-hour police station substation for downtown. In the Section 5 or the Midtown section of our police department. When you look at the number of new lofts and other buildings that are being renovated in downtown Rochester, you know, I think that we're on the right track. The fact that Hart's Grocer opened up in downtown Rochester is also, you know, wonderful. And we're filling in the inner loop. And so we are, you know, at a point where every project is moving forward. And I think that the vision that Larry Glazer had for downtown Rochester will be a reality in the coming years.
Now, with the Interloop project, the mayor just did something that I mistakenly did for years. Every time I say we're filling in the Interloop, somebody says we're filling in a third of
yes.
the Interloop.
Because yes,
people always
portion.
Yell at me for getting that wrong. Right now it's a third. Maybe in the future it could be more. But a big question has been what goes in that space.
Mm-hmm.
And we're now at a point where we can conceivably say by mid to end of the summer, we should know?
Well, we should know that how we're going to develop it.
Sure.
Now, of course,
yeah, that's what I mean.
this has to go to City Council, and we will brief City Council on a plan that our neighborhood and business development folks think is a way that we should go as a community in, you know, how we divide up the parcels. What do the parcels look like? And so we will brief them on that, and if City Council approved, because you know, the sale, lease, and purchase of land has to be approved by City Council. And so once they're on, once they give their direction, we'll be able to move forward.
Question on Twitter comes from Benjamin. Says, could we get a breakdown of the mayor's typical workday? How much time does she spend on administrative versus policy issues? There's no typical day for a mayor, but what's a day like for you?
No, there is no typical day. Let's see here. I have meetings all day. You know, most of the time I start off by putting my daughter on the bus and she gets on a bus around 7:10, go into the office and, you know, meet with the deputy mayor. We are briefed on different issues that's happening. From there, we have meetings with department heads and talk about whatever development is coming up and what policy issues. Sometimes we have to have meetings with City Council, depending on what the issue is. Of course, the police chief, and then a meeting with people in our business community and people talking to our federal representatives or our state representatives. And so there's no real typical day, but I can tell you that a day does not end at 5 o'clock. It usually runs well into the evening, 7, 8 o'clock at night.
Jackson, a note asking, why are you not taking calls? I just want to briefly say we are not declining to take calls for any reason or any precondition with Mayor Warren. We already took some calls. We're just making sure the phone lines are all up to speed, working properly. That's that. In fact, the mayor never sets conditions for interviews coming in. I just want to make that clear in case anybody was wondering. But some of the folks who did try to call had some questions off air. So Bill called and had a question about why Rochester's poverty problem is different from other cities. I don't know exactly more if he could clarify. I guess Bill is saying, is it more concentrated? Is it worse than many others, and why is it worse? Mayor, speaking generally, how would you answer that?
Well, I think that when we look at other urban cities similarly situated in our country, you know, like Cleveland and Cincinnati and Pittsburgh, they have been able to stem the tide or turn the boat around, I guess, when it comes down to poverty. I think that our industry was, you know, Kodak, Bausch & Lomb, and Xerox, you know, they left later, and they change later. So I think that we are in a situation where their industry started leaving earlier than ours, and so we're seeing the residual effects of that. We also are seeing the residual effects of a failed educational system for a number of generations that we're having to deal with now, and you know, starting to come back from that and really focusing on children's education and providing them and their parents with alternatives, rather than charter schools or private schools, and looking at that as options. Also, we are looking at how to really build a stairway out of poverty. And when you have to have a different sort of industry that you're looking at. So when my parents, my mom came here in the late 1960s, early 70s, there was a factory that they could go work in and make a living wage job. And now that's not the case here anymore. Manufacturing has changed. And so since manufacturing has changed, how do you prepare your people to work in the new environment? And that's going to take a while. And so we're starting to do that now. We're starting to look at the middle skills gap, working with MCC and Operation Transformation Rochester and our businesses to say, what is it that you want? What is it that you're looking for? And that was the reason why we went after the IMCP designation from the federal government, because it was important that we told the world that we still do manufacturing here in Rochester. And what we do well is we do optics and photonics and advanced manufacturing. And if you want a company, if you're a company that's looking to do business in those fields, look to Rochester. If you're looking for people to work in those particular fields, then you need to relocate here. And so it's one of the reasons why we're going after the NNMI application to become the photonics capital of the world. And we are one of three finalists. This is being headed up and led by U of R and RIT, and you know, all of our federal representatives and our governor and our state delegation are all in support of this, and we're all pushing for Rochester to be the place where this happens. This will mean that over a significant period of time, and in the next 10 years, we could possibly bring 10,000 jobs to this area. And so it's going to be refocusing on jobs and looking at how do we prepare our workforce for the industry that we have today. And that's the reason why I think that we're in a situation that we're in now.
I've had a number of political leaders on the program in the last few months, and they all have a slightly different answer to this question. Bill Nojay, Rich Funke, Joe Morelli will be here Thursday. We'll see what he says. We talk about whether the Buffalo Billion worked, because for years we heard, well, Rochester ought to get its equal share, et cetera. So let me start with this. How much time do you spend looking at Buffalo and trying to ascertain whether these public-private partnerships are working?
Well, actually, I went to visit Buffalo and sat down and talked to the Buffalo mayor just to see how, how the Buffalo Billion worked and what they did as a region to start to rebuild their industry. And in some ways, it did work, but in other ways, and he's going to talk about this, I just saw him this past weekend at the State of State, when it came down to the most, challenged population, that the changes have not really affected that portion of it yet, that community yet. And so how do you get the results that's happening when it comes down to redevelopment and industry development to really impact your most challenged community? And that is, how do you bring them up to speed to the industry that they have today? They're building a new solar plant. And so our most challenged population in Buffalo, they'll be able to work there. And those are things that we have to look at as a community. And that's the reason why we started the Office of Innovation and Strategic Initiatives, so that they can look at, okay, what are other cities doing? What's those new bright ideas that have been tested and tried, so that we can bring that here to really impact the challenged population? What we may do for high tech industry and for photonics and optics may be completely different than what we do for our challenged population. And that's the reason why we're looking at the market-driven co-op, which is a model out of Cleveland called the Evergreen Co-op model. And I'll give a plug to somebody. Alex White talked about this during the mayoral campaign about co-ops, and I'll give credit where credit is due. And so we took a look at that, and we're going to city council tomorrow. We'll be voting on, rather, to bring the consultants that actually developed the Evergreen model to Rochester, to develop the Rochester model. And that will allow people in our most challenged neighborhoods the opportunity to work in an industry and actually own, become part owners in that business so that they have an invested interest in that. And thinking of those bright ideas and how we impact that most challenged population is something that our Office of Innovation is going to be doing.
I think we can get line five, and that's exactly the subject that Bonnie wanted to talk about. Go ahead, Bonnie.
Yes, I'm glad to hear what Mayor Warren just said, because it was the Green Party who's been actually pushing this for a long time. But one of the big pieces of this is that in talking about concentrated poverty, of course, jobs are a key piece of that. And so one of the things we really want to see happen, though, in a very serious, intense way, is that the poorest areas of the city, which we know pretty much every area has some poverty, but the Northeast, the Northwest, are some of the poorest areas of the city, and we really want to see attention and a high priority given to these areas for this kind of development, because it's often the only kind of jobs that people who don't have a lot of other opportunities would have. And so we're going to be watching very closely to see that the neighbors in those areas are involved strongly, and that those particular areas that are most in need are really should be the priority for these kinds of options, as was the one from Cleveland. They did an industrial laundry, and that was in one of the poorest neighborhoods. So the model does work there, and we would expect to see it the same outcomes in our poor neighborhoods. So thank you.
Yeah, Bonnie, thanks for the call.
Well, absolutely. And as I said, what we, you know, there's more than one way to skin a cat. And so I think that you have to think about what you do for your high-tech industry and make sure that you're building those relationships and working with your businesses to make sure that they have their needs for high-tech industry. But you also have to figure out a way to really impact your most impoverished and challenged neighborhoods. In the Evergreen co-op model is one way that we believe that we can do that. And we want to start off small. You know, we want to develop a model that we know can really impact and change poverty here, and not do it in such a way that we overwhelm ourselves so that we don't do anything well. I think that, you know, what we try to do and what we've done in the past is we, you know, try to attack the problem from a macro level instead of a micro level. And we want to look at this at a micro level. That's what the Office of Innovation and Strategic Initiatives will allow us to do, is say, we know in this particular census tract, how do you move poverty by 1%? How much does, you know, 10 people in this particular area need to know and need to make in order to move poverty? What support do we need to provide to them in order to make them, self-sufficient and self-sustaining, and give them that support and give their children that support? That's one of the things that I believe that the Anti-Poverty Task Force will help us with, but we'll also be doing the co-op model as well, so that we can concentrate on those most challenged areas.
A few more minutes with Rochester Mayor Lovely Warren. Rochester's not getting that billion the same way Buffalo did, but Rochester competing for $500 million pots that will be awarded to 3 of 7 upstate communities. Everybody knows Rochester's going to get one of those five. There's no secret here, right? I mean, Rochester is getting that money, right? Right, Mayor Warren?
Yes, we are.
You're here to say they are. I mean,
yes, we are.
It would be an absolute shock, I think, to everybody if we did not. But are you okay with the notion of this being a competition with the possibility of Rochester not receiving that money?
Well, of course, you don't want to have to compete, but I don't get to make the rules. And the rules have been outlined, and we are going to compete for these dollars. I think that as a community, we work really well together. That was the reason why we were able to secure the IMCP designation from the federal government. I think that will be the reason why we are chosen as a global manufacturing hub. We're one of 3 finalists now for that. And I think that working together, we'll be able to accomplish whatever we want to accomplish. The fact that the University of Rochester, RIT, MCC, myself, the county executive, our business leaders here in our community are all at the table working together to say, you know, Rochester, we're going to put a plan together that's led by our Finger Lakes Regional Economic Development Council. you know, to compete for these dollars, and we're going to be very, very competitive for it.
In the next hour, I got about 80 seconds left. In the next hour on this program today, we're going to be talking about the way Rochester City School District disciplines teachers. Governor Cuomo's talked about the need to, in his view, make sure we get rid of bad teachers, make sure our kids have the very, very best. A lot of people have come on this program, Bill Calla and others, who've said that's a red herring. The biggest issue is poverty. If you don't fix poverty, you don't fix schools, period. Which side of that are you on?
I disagree with them, and I believe that we cannot allow poverty to be an excuse for miseducating kids. And I think that no one rises to low expectations, and as long as you allow poverty to be the excuse, it will always be the excuse. We're always going to have poor people with us. There is no way we're going to be able to eradicate poverty. It's how we deal with our poor that is going to be the difference. We need to make sure that we give them the ability and the support in order to be able to live the American dream if that's what they choose to, if that's what they want to do. But is poverty a factor? Absolutely. But it cannot be used as the excuse.
We're not always going to have the concentration of poverty, I would hope, though, that we have here, right?
Oh, no. I think that, you know, we shouldn't always have the concentration of poverty. But this is not, you know, as you said when I first sat down, you know, we have been impoverished in concentrated poverty for, you know, decades. And so, therefore, that's not going to be something that we change overnight. It's going to be something that's changed over time. And that may be 10, 20 years from now. Well, I have a 4-year-old daughter. She can't wait 20 years for us to deal with this issue. Poverty is not going to be solved next year. And so what do you do in the meantime?
Yeah. Mayor Lovely Warren joining us for the hour. She's going to help fix the phone lines, and she'll come back sometime when the phone lines are working, and then we'll take some more calls.
Absolutely.
Here. But I always enjoy the conversation. I appreciate your
Thank
time.
Thank you, Evan.
Thank you very
appreciate
much.
It.
Short break, and conversation continues about schools next hour on Connections.